Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cup. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond. Blech.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that down. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you're tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that down. Wiggly.
Yeah, yeah, this is Cassidy, the hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw. And you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio. And I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
Hey, what it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West West, y'all.
Bad boy.
Beware,
there. How dare he make the remix so deadly?
That's right.
Shazam, Gumo be my pal like Shazam. I'm running to you like shoes, oh you who's, and I choose from the fly thing that you do. You dudes, can't you see like total? Kissing you got Gina running for the boulder. Hit me on my car phone. You got the hydro with me and you can roll. We can take a stroll on the beach, but bad boy, don't take your love away from me.
That's right.
Are you ready? Are you ready for this? Do you like it? Do you like it like this? Are you ready? Are you ready for this? Do you like it? Do you like it like this? Are you ready? Are you ready for this? Do you like it? Do you like it like this? Are you ready? Are you ready for this? Do you like it? All star.
My feet, Lord,
team camp, train by stack. Infiltrate, combine minds to back line. And the front to watch choke. Dark and donuts, the slugs and VIP. Same last name. Legalize the fame. Switch across from the drug game to the rap game. Say my name.
We are now tuned in to episode 563, live and direct from Off the Cuff Radio, show sponsored by Screwball Radio. You can catch that on Saturday nights, Fleetwood and the Cock Pickers, Buddy Boy Entertainment, Da Vinci Clothing. I got T-Max on the line. What's good?
Man, what it do, y'all? Another magnificent Monday on the freshest frequency of the internet. Keep you interested all the time. It is Off the Cuff Radio. Shout out to our host of Spirit, a lot of fan man and Lady Chinchilla. Of course, shout out to Dirty Basement Radio and all of our many, many, many super intermediaries, sponsors. And tonight, King, this is a very, very, very special show because our guest tonight is one of the epitomes of R&B fantasticness. This girl has had one of the most classic club bangers for all generations with her tremendous talent. She definitely, when you think of artistry, talent, and most important, integrity, and just being a whole vibe, she is it. King, let's go ahead and bring in our special guest, man.
Yes, indeed, man. What's all welcome, the lovely Gina Thompson, to Off the Cuff Radio 563, and big shout out to Angela for making this happen. What's good?
Absolutely. What's up, lady?
Good evening, good evening. Wow, what a great introduction. That was lovely. I appreciate that. How you fellas doing?
We are doing good tonight.
Yes.
Awesome, awesome, awesome. I love the energy. Oh, it's always good stepping into good energy. I really appreciate that.
Yes, indeed.
Gina,
yes,
we appreciate
indeed, because,
you so much. Yeah.
Yeah, yes, indeed, because what it is and what we do, we don't only just cover hip-hop. We also cover R&B. Whoever's dope in the genre, we usually cover. We got R&B, unsung heroes, legendary people, politicians, poets, whatever you got, whatever the gab is, as long as you dope, it's all good. But we definitely love to have you on. This is a part of our bucket list.
That's what's up. That's love right there. I appreciate that. Yeah, I respect that what y'all do. That's good money.
Man, look, more than good money, this is something that generates interest and brings all types of dope returns on that ROI. You know, we are fully invested in this with the stock of it. Gina, you are one of the queens of, you know, R&B in terms of the classics you've created. I mean, the vibe that you brought. And it's not us trying to be the angry old men when we say this, but we got to say this to our listeners. If you were born in between the years of 1982 and 1995, you have to have an understanding of the significance of the impacts you and your contemporaries had on hip-hop and R&B. You know, we're talking about Sadu, we're talking about Puff Daddy, we're talking about Missy, we're talking about Terry and Monica, we're talking about Entice, Drama, you know, a 76-69, Boys to Men, Men of Vision, UNB, Universal Nubian Voices. For those that don't know, you know, 3T, you know, Michael Jackson's nephews. I mean, we could go on and on and on. You're part of that distinguished class of folks.
Yeah,
I mean, you all, yeah, you know, you all wrote a super symphony of a soulful soundtrack that transcends generations and it still resonates to this day. We are so happy to have you. Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. Let's get it going. Like 18 Wheel is traveling. Let's get it.
Okay. Yeah. So, well, first and foremost, again, I sincerely thank you for your support, for allowing me to be a part of, you know, your the thing that you're doing tonight. I truly appreciate that. So, most people, you know, that do know me, I am from South Jersey. It's a town called Violet. It's Cumberland County. And I basically, you know, would tell people that I was born and raised into a musically inclined family where, you know, we just all loved music. Everybody could sing, or if it was an instrument they played, it was just some type of music, you know, blessing that, you know, that we all had and or have. And so with that being said, my parents pretty much had us in church choirs. Even some of us were on school, you know, we participated in school choirs and local talent shows, you name it. And so as I became older and became a teenager, a couple relatives of mine, my brother and, you know, cousins and things along those lines decided that they wanted to, you know, see how my voice sounded on a track. So I went into one of my brother's friend's studio at the time, and things kind of moved forward from that after we kind of heard that result. And then my mother had, one time we had went to like this boardwalk in Wildwood, New Jersey. And you know how some of those boardwalks, how they have like those little recording studios, people go in there and record over a track, whatever the case may be. So I had did that as well. And just the feedback, I mean, it was like in all honesty speaking, people like just stopped on the boardwalk when I was singing. And it was kind of like things kind of went from that time. And my mom and my family was like, you know what? We want to see you do more lead stuff. So I, moving forward a little bit, I was introduced to Rodney Jerkins back in 94, the end of 94. Yeah, Dark Child, Rodney Jerkins. Sang for him instantly. He loved it, signed me on the spot. 3 months later, several record companies became interested, and we ended up signing with Mercury, and that was in 96. And then the single, I'm sorry, 95, excuse me, the beginning of 95, first quarter, and then 96. My first single came out, and a lot of people don't know this. The Things You Do That We Know is actually the remix of the original, The Things You Do. Rodney Jerkins is the one who produced my first album, So Nobody Does It Better, and the original Things You Do was on that album. So my A&R at the time thought that, you know, since Puffy and Total and Faith and everybody who gets that sound, and things were just out at that time and Puffy being really big, thought it would be a good look for him to just kind of remix it, and so we made that the single. And so... So blessed. 27 years later, as you guys were pretty much saying, you know, the song is still out there, you know, and it's you know, and humbly speaking, it's iconic, you know, it's, and I'm thankful for that. And of course, Missy was featured on it. When they asked me if I wanted her to be on the record, I was like, hands down, her sound was so unique. So yeah, we, you know, collaborated, did our thing, and went and moved forward to a second album. With Electra, Leaving Mercury, you know, and Yada Yada was the first single off of my second unreleased album titled If You Only Knew, and that also featured Missy. So that pretty much is, I think that's a great deal right there, so I'm going to leave some room for questions.
It's all good.
Well,
first of all, we want to go to the current, then we're going to go right back to the past, to the present. So first of all, We in a new era. We in a new era. And tell us what you have going on, what you have planned for 2023.
Absolutely, as it is fastly leading us. So, if I may, I want to kind of start the beginning of 2023 because it'll make more sense to where my current is. Is that okay with you? Okay, perfect.
Please,
good.
Please.
Yeah, awesome. So I signed with I am with another company, if you will, but it's a little different. It's a Web3 label. It's called Infanity, and you can learn more about them on infanity.xyz It's, again, like a Web3 label. And what they do is they work more with, like, NFTs called non-fungible tokens, which that's a pretty deep conversation. So I just kind of leave it at, it's almost like a crypto-type currency deal with them. And it's kind of where the music industry, a lot of people are leaning more towards that, because it's the artists and artistry are being able to do so much more with their craft. So nevertheless, I signed with them roughly February, March of earlier this year. And we went in the studio, and the concept that they wanted to do to kind of like reintroduce me back into the you know, world, if you will, they wanted to take the things you do and remix that with a twist of a concept. So I went ahead and I recorded the things you do with the Leftovers, whom are my label mates. So it's the things you do, the Leftovers featuring Gina Thompson. Singles out, videos out on all platforms. A really great remix. After that, I released another single, which just dropped the 25th of this month on all platforms. It's titled Starvin', and that's just me. And it's actually getting some good reviews so far, so I'm super excited about that. But again, yes, I am with Insanity, and as the year continues to proceed, we're going to continue to, you know, market that. A video is soon going to be coming. I've already started doing shows, looking to do more shows, and, you know, just spread love, man, and let people know, you know, that I'm back, I'm working. And a lot of that is owed to Pass the Mic that I did back in March 2021 with DJ Cassidy. So, you know, after that show, things kind of just started spinning and brought me up to a date where we're at right now.
Man, to see you still going strong after all these years, Gina, is a godsend. Yeah. It is definitely a testament to your tenacity, your perseverance, and your soul is so needed right now in an era where we look at music today, and the era we came up in, it really meant a lot in terms of, we understand this as children of the culture, listening to all types, you know, King and myself, you know, my brother, we grew up in that era of where hip hop and R&B were blended beautifully. There was no real distinction between the two, you know, and we listen to everything. So we understand, you know, what it is in terms of what it means to really have that balance, where today we're kind of seeing a proliferation of the same cookie cutter sound that does not promote diversity, but kind of just is on repeat. When you think about what was going on from your start, and shout out to Rodney Jerkins, because y'all are both a Jersey natives. He's from Pleasantville. You know, we got to give our listeners, and I don't want to go too far back, but, you know, want to keep it current. By the same time, it's like, if you are a child of the culture like we are and you've studied it, the years of 1993, between 1993 and 1996, are considered the second golden age, even if you want to push it back to 1992. But the level of R&B that came out in that time, God knows.
And
you had Missy on your track, and Missy was 2 years into her career after she was with a group called Sista. If everybody remembers that, with the song they had Brand New. So Missy was still coming into the game with what you and her would end up teaming up to do a classic. I mean, Gina, I mean, tell us what it was like at that time in terms of just the energy with R&B, just with the music and the industry in general.
Absolutely. I always want to start off by saying, you know, I definitely give an honor to God, and I thank him for allowing me to, you know, be a part of, you know, reaching a dream of mine, and just, you know, blessing me and, you know, and enabling me to collaborate with such phenomenal acrobats, I call them. As you said it earlier, the energy, you know, it's absolutely amazing working with, you know, people like Missy, Rodney, Timberland. You know, being in the studio, you know, seeing Aaliyah even do work, and God bless her soul, and several other artists, you know, like you said, I mean, you know, that time it just was, you know, the music was, you know, you had that nice, that nice sound, just that good music, and you can understand what people were saying and relate, and, you know, and being able to, you know, still even sing along with them and understanding what they're saying versus, you know, remove the auto-tunes or whatever from the voice because I'm not really understanding what they're saying. You was, and no disrespect to auto-tunes, but I'm just saying you were able to really relate and, you know, go in the studio and hear, you know, that real good singing and, you know, and it was just so amazing. So, you know, around that time, like I said, you know, just the collaboration and just to see the work brought together, you know, the originality and, you know, just the gifts that people brought to make that final project. The whole making of the process of was just absolutely phenomenal, and things just came together, and the energy was just so, you know, contagious, and just came together like a hand in glove. And so I have to say that every experience and every artist that I worked with, MC Light, Diamond D, Ill Out Scratch, Christopher Williams, you know, Missy, of course, and like I already mentioned, Diddy, Puffy, and I'm sorry, Diddy and Timberland. Mocha, she was an artist of Missy that she and I actually did the feature song on the Why Do Fools Fall in Love soundtrack. She was awesome to work with. Little Mo, Nicole Ray, Show Pepsi Riley. The list goes on. Everybody that I actually had an encounter with, it was a blessing. So, you know, the energy was good. Just traveling, just doing it all, and working, just collaborating was just absolutely phenomenal.
Plus on top of that, y'all really gel with one another. Like when it comes to wanting to work with certain producers or certain artists, it wasn't like it kind of is now where you feel like you got to work with this person to boost your streams, or you know you got to work with this person to boost your sales or whatever. Back in the day, if you the people at the time really just wanted to work with you because you just happened to be talented.
Absolutely. Yep. I'm sorry, was that a question, or you just was? I wasn't sure if that was a question or if you was just,
I was just making a statement about that's how it was back in the day. That's what made the magic of music.
I agree. Yeah, I totally agree. Absolutely. And also shout out to Beanie Siegel and Jazzy Jeff and John B. I don't know how I even left them out. They played a pivotal, you know, part in my second unreleased album. It was Shmonta Jordan, Shep Crawford. They really, you know, really helped to bring that. That was a power album. Really wish that it would have came out. But, yeah, like I said, again, the energy, absolutely contagious. And, you know, you just enjoyed every moment of it. It was a blessing.
When we look at that time, because there is a lightning in a bottle energy of what was going on at that particular moment, because, you know, especially when, you know, you came in from your deal being signed in 1995 to, you know, those 5 years between 95 and 2000, I mean, you know, like you said, Beanie, John B., you know, I mean, there was, you know, with all the names we mentioned, you know, it's just like literally we would be here for the next 10 hours talking about, I mean, just, look, when we think about all those albums and songs that came out during that time, yours included, I mean, it's literally, you're just never going to find something like that again to have all of that. I think about, shout out to my neighborhood, Georgetown, where we're from. We had a neighborhood reunion over the weekend, and the DJ was playing a lot of that old 90s R&B. And I was thinking to myself, damn, we were really spoiled.
Yes, indeed.
We were.
Yeah, every region was on fire.
You're right. Yeah. Totally agree to that.
Thinking about that, when you look at what was going on, what was it like in terms of the process, Regina, that you went through? I mean, obviously, Rod signed you on the spot, you know, and he's one of the underappreciated legends, and then, you know, in terms of his legendary work he's done. In terms of the process of what it meant to get signed, be in the studio, budget for album, tell our listeners what it was like in terms of just that whole process, because a lot of artists today, we look at the internet as being instantaneous of celebrity. And it's a simultaneous thing because we see for a lot of young artists, you know, they're doing it themselves, which we love. You know, we on Off the Cuff, we're independent. Mm-hmm. We do what we do. But we also mm-hmm. understand mm-hmm. how important it is to have the knowledge and, you know, the passion. And we don't want to shade nobody when we say this, but we got to keep it real, the talent.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
What did you all learn? What did you learn about that time in terms of what it meant to really be in the business and what you really had to do in terms of really making yourself a sell?
So, great question. And I actually learned a lot. And one thing that I can say, you said a key word in the question itself, which is business. So what I mean by that, I'll elaborate. Basically, in any business, if you don't conduct yourself as such or run your business, then you're really not going to have much of a business. So one of the things that I really, like, encourage people, even though you are maybe an artist, like, and you may, you know, or you should have people like your managers, you know, and your business managers, attorneys, and things along those lines that, you know, are handling your business, because you do want to focus on your craft as well and enhance it and make that, you know, as good as it can be. But it's still very, very important to learn how this process works and learn about the business side of things and how does the artist make money and, you know, and just, you know, just be mindful of that, because in a lot of businesses as well, you know, people want to make money and there's a lot of vultures in businesses. So one of the big things that I did learn is, you know, don't put your full trust in no man. I'm a spiritual individual, so let me first say that. Don't put your full trust in no man but God. Now, there are people, of course, in your corner that you're going to have some level of trust, but, you know, and to each his own, you know. But the one thing that I've learned is that you really need to just stay on top of your game. And you need to have good, solid plans on, you know, how you want your business to, you know, to work or to run and be a part of that creation. You know, don't just sit back and let anybody just do anybody and everybody just, you know, tell you what to do and make all these decisions for you. Be a part of that decision-making process. And that way you can learn that way as well. And then when decisions are to be made, they're made more with informed decisions is what I call them. So, again, just like with any business, you want to learn the business. Just going into it and not having a clue or understanding what's going on, it's not good. It's just really, really not good. So that's one of the things that I learned. I had to learn the hard way. You know, I was very vulnerable and naive, if you will. I mean, unfortunately, it happens to a lot of artists because you get these deals. You're like, oh my gosh! And for many people, especially if you were brought up in like a, you know, the poverty type, you know, living environment, you get a $10,000 or $25,000 check. Everything else you don't even see, and it's just kind of like, and you're just doing this, and no one's telling you, well, you better pay taxes off of that, and this person has to get this, and this person gets this. And then you're finding yourself, you know, hey, you know, I got $2,000 out of a million. What happened here? But nevertheless, again, it's just understanding, knowing what you have, knowing that it is a business. And again, conduct yourself as such. I can't emphasize that enough. That's the biggest thing, the biggest thing. Publishing, write as much as you can. Money is in the publishing. It's in production, you know. So those are things that I've learned, you know, throughout the years. But in the midst of it all, I will say it was truly a blessing because we learn from our good and our bad, and we grow. So, you know, it made me who I am today, and I'm still learning.
Yeah, experience could be your best teacher.
That's basically what it is. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. One thing, Gina, when you said about having input and taking an interest in your own, and I'm going to preface this by saying that these were speculations, but you know, like you talked about with your project, the same thing happened with Cannabis years ago where, you know, he spit in his later song after his first joint, Can I Bust, on another album. He talked about, you know, what Wyclef spoiled it. Because Wyclef basically, you know, Cannabis was just looking at it at the time, you know, this is coming in 98 after, you know, 2 years after the Fugees' great success of The Score, and Wyclef basically filmed the whole project. Now, there was rumors. That's why I said I prefaced this by rumors and speculation. Because Cannabis, for all of our listeners that remember this, Cannabis was blazing it up at the time. And there was a rumor that a lot of the best, the top producers, like Dr. Dre, there was a rumor Dr. Dre, DJ Premier, there was a lot of these producers that wanted to get on the album because they were like, yo, it is fire. You know, we want a part of it. And Wyclef basically, you know, kind of was like, nah, I'm going to do this. And, you know, Cannabis' thing was, okay, this guy's a big producer. I'm going to just let him do everything. And then the album flopped. You know, and but that is an illustration of how you have to know what is going on at all times with your project in terms of being mindful and making sure that whoever is involved with it, that their vision is aligned with your vision, and you both have a united goal in terms of creating the best work possible. From the first album, obviously was a hit. You know, what was it like in terms of the promo tours, videos? I mean, you know, as you look back, we'll get to what happened with the second project later because we want our listeners to have every aspect of education, of understanding how things don't always go as planned from the business aspect. But let's concentrate on the positive right now in terms of what was it like when you, you know, doing those recording sessions and, you know, just to not only the things that you do, you know, in the remix, but just the whole record in general. What was the whole overall vibe like? And then what was it like when y'all did the remix? Did y'all know it was going to be as big as it was?
Yeah, so great question again. So the whole entire process recording, we did pre-production first, and I didn't say that. I'm saying it now. So Rodney and myself did pre-production in his basement at his home, and then we went ahead and did the recording. At most of it was at I think it was I know it was a studio in Manhattan. The tip of it, the name of the studio is at the tip of my tongue, but nevertheless, it was a really Hit Factory. There you go. Hit Factory Studio in
New York City. Yeah.
It was so amazing. I remember Dexter being my engineer at the time, and Rodney did have, you know, his brother also do a few, Fred Jerkins, do a few tracks on the album as well. Just that whole process, like I said, it was my first album, you know, so the experience was absolutely phenomenal, you know. I mean, this is like a dream come true, you know. So, again, you know, being able to, you know, hear that finished product and like, oh, my gosh, this is me. This is the creation. And, you know, this is the process. Long, long night. Don't get me wrong, but so well worth it in the end when you hear that finished product. And we worked very quickly with some long nights, but that was the one thing that I was grateful for, again, that with Rodney and myself, you know, I love using this analogy, work together as a hand in glove. Like we did, it was just such a cohesive fit. And he just kind of, it was just a perfect fitting, you know. And so every song that we did, and I even co-wrote, you know, a few songs on the album as well, you know, was awesome. We had good feedback from every track we did. You know, sometimes in making an album, the process is a lot of tracks are submitted. You may even record so many of them, and then the label kind of comes together, and then they may pick out the ones that they like. Well, with Rodney and myself, every song that we did, that they accepted. So we didn't even have that whole library of, you know, tracks that we did, and that was a blessing. So that was that process. And then again, once the album was completed, everyone came together. One of the things you do original, you know, they really, really was stuck on that song. And then, my A&R was saying that he heard Puffy, just kind of felt that Puffy could do a nice remix to it and put it out. So when Puffy heard the record, he jumped on it right away and had something in mind. And him and Rodney, yeah, they went to work at it. And so then I just went over to Puffy Studio and re-recorded my vocals. And like I said earlier, you know, they asked about, you know, Puffy said he heard Missy on it. They asked my, you know, how did I feel about it? And I was like, absolutely, and Rodney. And then Puffy said once that project was finished, you know, he told my A&R at the time, like, listen, y'all got a hit, but it's up to y'all what y'all going to do with it. You know, so Puffy had knew from the gate. I'm going to be honest with you, myself, I just didn't know because I was like, but I knew that he was hot. So I was like, you know, hey, it's one of those things, you know, I'm new to the game. What do I know? I'm just a little girl that's trying to, you know, sing. And so vocally, though, I knew that the way that the vocals came across, I was like, that's not really me, but I could do it at that time. And it was just kind of what they wanted. So I did it. And I don't regret it. 27 years later, okay. So
it was, hey, still pays
thing.
The bill.
Yeah, yeah. Well, not my bills, but well,
okay.
No,
okay.
But it does for
it.
Others. But I'm still happy because at the end of the day, my name is still there, and that's something nobody can take from me. So I'm honored, I'm grateful, and I'm okay with that. So, you know, and it did give me a great deal of money when I was touring. And you asked about that, about the promo tour, I think a little while ago as well. Touring, that was great. The record company had put me on the road. I had dancers, and we went from various cities, and just had a ball, you know. It truly was a, you know, dream come true. And, you know, and then unfortunately things kind of had changed up with the business side of things. And it was just the best interest for me to depart at that moment. And a second single never came out. Nobody left with no beef or nothing like that. You know, sometimes business things happen and you just got to keep it moving. And again, that's sometimes what a business is about. So because me and Missy had already, you know, connected, you know, I started doing singing for her as she was touring throughout the country, you know, out of the country. And then Sylvia Rome, who was the, I guess, the president or whomever at Elektra at that time, her and Missy thought it'd be a good idea for me to join the Elektra family. So now I can pause there because I do believe you said you wanted to just kind of focus on the first album and then maybe talk about the second later.
We're going to guide the mothership the right way. You know what I'm saying? We got a good vibe going on with that. And we, you know, talking about the album and everything. We all, you know, working with P. Diddy. You know, people told stories about Puff being a pain in the ass, being difficult. Like, what was your experience personally? Like,
not at all. Not at all. And I didn't even really see him much. I just know Puffy. So with that whole experience, you know, Puffy, he does his thing. And he doesn't, I don't think he really stays put for so long. He comes in and does what he does so quickly, or did what he did so quickly. 112, many people don't know this, but 112 is on the back, is singing some background on the bridge. But they, as well as myself, kind of helped made the arrangements of the lyrics. And we all kind of like had a piece in there. Yeah, we all had a piece in there. And so I went in there, recorded it, and like I said, didn't really see Puffy too much, but the times that I did, he was definitely, it was all good. I didn't have that interaction with him, but I wasn't around him like that neither. I will say that I know Biggie's, he was a very nice, very, very, like, I thought he was a big teddy bear. You know, many people may have, you know, I can't say his interactions, how it was for others. I cannot speak for others, but I can speak for myself. And he showed me love at my video shoot. I know that he was saying he wanted to do some work with me, but unfortunately, you know, that didn't come.
Yeah, March 9th.
He was so quiet. He was calm. I mean, I remember him smiling, and our conversation wasn't much, but, you know, the times that I did see him, it was all love. I just, some of the things that I heard about or whatever, it just blew me away. But I know that me and Biggie, I didn't have no problems with him. I didn't have no problems with Lil C's. I didn't have no problems with Lil Kim. But I can't speak for nobody else.
And we've talked to a few people who knew Big, and we've heard the same thing. Big was just just that nigga that you just love to be around. You know, he had jokes.
Yes, he did.
Just had a, you know, he had a great personality. You know, he was just, you know, good guy Chris. You know, when he wasn't, you know, on the stage, you know, he was just, you know, just that guy, you know, you just chung out with.
Laid back, very laid back.
Yeah. When you think about, we're listening to this history of Gina, and one thing that is, that just strikes us is that, and during that time period, it's almost like it wasn't an issue if these people knew something was going to work to just get on the phone and call people. And the thing is also too, it also seemed a very genuine kind of outreach when you wanted to bring somebody in. This wasn't necessarily about, well, let's try to bank as much as we can. No, it was about a vision that people saw in the music that could be expanded beyond the scope of what the original recording was going to be and how we can really do justice to additions. Even with the magazine, you know, you look at the Source XXL magazines back in the day with Biggie, Puff, Jay, Nas, you know, Tupac, you know, and it was like, it was just, Ice Cube, and it was just like, it was just nothing to get them on. It was like all you had to do was call them. And it's like, we look at it years later, it's like these guys are in a whole different place. Some of them are not with us anymore, and it's like, but the ones that are, it's like it ain't even like that where you could just reach out and get them anymore.
That's right.
When you look at all your contemporaries that you were working with, I mean, because you came across a lot of people along the way with Big, you know, I don't know if you met Jay. Of course, you work with, you know, MC Lyte on her 7 and 7 album. What was it like watching the ascent of the Burgoyne legend and then at the time working with legends that had already had their legacy established?
Truly an honor. I mean, I really don't even know what else to even say with that. I mean, to want me to be a part of their project, you know, and being a new artist, you know, I was definitely grateful. Honestly speaking, every person that I have worked with in the industry, I haven't had a I didn't have any problems with any of them, you know. But the business is one of those things. Still, regardless of what, you meet people in the business and sometimes those relationships may go on for beyond, and then you have some, you know, when you're out of sight, you're out of mind, kind of one of those things. And so, like I said, at that moment when I was doing what I was doing, everybody that I work with, everyone showed love. There's not one person I can say I had any problems with. Now, I can't speak for them, you know, but I would hope that they would say working with me was not a problem. But yeah, it was a blessing. But as far as the legends like MC Lyte, and oh yeah, hands down, it was an honor. We didn't record the same time. She recorded at one point, I recorded at another, but we definitely spoke, you know. But she even gave permission she was sampled on my first album that Rodney did. Many people don't know this, but I have a song titled Put Me On, and she's sampled on that record, and it's a really nice song. So, you know, like I said, people like MC Lyte and really any and everybody else that I work with, you know, a blessing. And you're going to always hear me say it's a blessing, you know.
Absolutely. Going into the negotiations of after the first album, obviously, and then the second project. What were those conversations like in terms of when you got the deal for the second album, when it was greenlit? Obviously, it unfortunately didn't get a chance to get released. What was going on during that time in terms of that business aspect with everything of what was going in terms of everything that went on with that?
Okay, so starting from signing with them, again, you know, a blessing. I was very happy to become a part of the Elektra family. They had a really good roster as well. I mean, Mercury did too. So just thinking about, you know, what was to come, Missy being executive producer, I'm kind of like co-executive producer. So, you know, it was very, very, it was so ecstatic for me. So what I liked was at that time as well, you know, Missy kind of was like, you know, just go ahead and kind of gave me the green light to just try to put the album together. She gave me a lot of control is basically what she did. And I know a lot of that had to do with her being so very busy herself, you know, running Goldmine and then the artist and then her own album, you know, and it was a lot for her. It really, really was. So me and my manager at that time, we decided that, hey, this is what we're going to do. They gave me a great budget. So that was absolutely awesome. So that wasn't even a problem. So that's how I was able to collaborate with people like Jazzy Jeff's Camp, Eric Roberson, John B, Montel Jordan, Shep Crawford, Beanie Siegel. I don't even know who. I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out. But nevertheless, just that whole process and working with everyone, traveling to the West Coast and traveling to Philly and doing all of that. It was different than the first album, more so because Rodney did, and like I said, his brother did the first album. Not that I'm trying to go backwards, but just wanted to throw that little comparison
in there. No, go ahead.
Yeah, the second album was much more diverse, much more, and I was able to even exhibit more of my writing skills, and I was also challenged vocally with Shep Crawford, so it was kind of like, that second album, If You Only Knew, really, really, really showcased, you know, more of my abilities and more of my art. And I was so, so appreciative of that. I even had written a song that featured my son. At the time, I had the one son, and I was missing him so much because I was the traveling I was doing. So Jazzy Jeff's Camp, you know, worked with me production-wise. Gave me a nice track, and they also kind of helped with some of the arrangements of the song that I wrote. And then they, you know, I had my son on there. So that album, you know, really, really, really meant so much to me. Not that the first didn't, but because it was so much more control that I had with the second, and like I said, the diversity of it, it was absolutely amazing. So when Yada Yada came out, which was the first single off of that album, featuring Missy, I loved it. It wasn't my choice for the first single. I wanted Ladies Anthem, that was written by Eric Roberson, but they wanted Yada Yada, and I think it had a lot to do with also because it was a song that Missy was featured, and it would be a nice follow-up after The Things You Do. So I was sold on that concept. However, a very similar situation. Let me take that adjective off.
Gotcha.
It was somewhat similar to my first deal, not very, very, no, where the album got shelved, but there was several artists with Elektra that I was told that were supposed to come out, and for whatever reason, and this is still a mystery to be honest with you, that many artists had got shelved. And then I end up hearing that Elektra ended up folding. Merging.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So I think it was a number of things that was happening. And so I got caught in that, and I said, wait a minute. Mm-mm. At this point, mentally, I just was so drained and exhausted, missing my son, and just really needed to just regroup and get myself together because of the emotional roller coasters was just not wearing well on my mental. So I asked my attorney at the time, just, you know what, let me just fall back. If we could work something out where the label will let me go, let's just do that so I can just go ahead and I got to take care of some things. And my attorney knew what I was talking about. So again, you know, that went through smoothly. They, you know, agreed. And prior to me doing that, I was offered if I wanted to go to another label, and I just and by my A&R at that time, and I just was like, no, you know what? Let me get back to life right now. So that's where I was, and you know, and that's where I stood for a million years for the most part. So, but for the most part, again, like I said earlier in our conversation, the past, the mic kind of reeled me back in. People started calling me and reaching out, and then I just started feeling some things again. And so that brings me to where I'm at today for the most part.
You know, to deal with what you deal with, that would have, you know, devastated and defeated a lot of people, yet you were resilient and your resolve to still have an interest in it. Another situation for our listeners, to kind of give a further context to this, and a lot of people don't know this, D'Angelo, the version of Voodoo that was ultimately released in 2000 was not the version that he had recorded. You know, similar to your situation, because the record, because that record was never, the original Voodoo was never released because EMI had folded in the United States. So D'Angelo had recorded like 70 hours of music. Let me say that again. He recorded 70 hours of music, and then he finds out that the record, that the label's folding, and that he couldn't have the album. So he essentially had to do this all over again.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's heartbreaking.
That's heartbreaking. This was back in 1997. Yeah, this was back in 1997, and he wouldn't release it until 2000. So that's to give our listeners an idea of what you had gone through in terms of you have this bomb-ass project, and then, you know, Elektra, you know, was beginning. I mean, you know, and it's noticed you had Beanie Siegel on it. So this is about a year with Beanie's career going in after he was on Jay-Z's Reservoir Dogs off of Hard Knock Life. And we're like, yo, who is this nigga right here? And I mean, you know, so it's like, you know what I mean? So you're getting prime Beans. Shout out to the whole Rock camp, too. I got to meet them a couple of months back when they were here in Virginia. And, of course, shout out Missy, being a Portsmouth native. All great people. I've got to meet all of them at one point or another. Terrific and tremendous individual. Just had to throw that in there. When you're looking at it from the perspective of it, because, Gina, this is something that a lot of people don't understand in terms of the hard times, the non-glamorous life of the industry. This is when you're kind of brought back down to earth. When you're thinking about when you were away, what was regular life for you in terms of just your day-to-day, being a mother, just going about your business, you know, doing your grown woman thing? What was that like during that time?
Okay, let me make sure I'm understanding the question. Are you saying while I was in the industry or when I decided to just give it
when
a break?
When you decided to step away. When you decided to step away.
Okay.
When you gave it a break.
Okay. Okay, so first off, it felt good to be a mother to my son, you know. I felt that there was a mixture of emotions because I definitely was hurt, you know, with the things that had happened and, you know, with the industry. You know, I was definitely devastated. But at the same token, you know, real life is, you know, here's my son, you know, and these are crucial moments of his upbringing. And so I need to be here for him. And then just as equally important, get my sanity. Because it just, again, like I said, with the devastation, it was traumatizing, the things that happened, you know? And so it felt really good, but again, it had its moments of, it was very painful. But I would not change it then, nor would I now, because my son needed me, if that makes sense. Like, it was... Even though coming home was worth it because come on, I'm his mother and he only gets one mother and he was my only child and I really needed to just be around more and I had saw that. So it was needed. And also, you know, I started saying to myself, again, as I mentioned to you earlier, I'm a very spiritual person and strong belief in God. My thing is, God works in such mysterious ways. And a lot of times we may want something, and he may not say it's the time for us to have that. We may think that it is, and we may think that it's best for us, you know. But if things aren't going the way they should be and he feels he may need to pull you back so you can get back on track, he'll do it in some type of way. But he'll get you your attention somehow, and like I said, some way. And I feel like everything happened for a reason. It really did. And I say that to bring me to where I'm going now. Basically, when I came out of the industry and I started, you know, getting myself back together, I started learning that I suffered from depression and anxiety significantly. And I tried to manage it my own way, you know. I was somewhat in denial and just angry, and just, and it wasn't the music industry that did it to me. I had this before then. And again, this how I knew this was after I God had set me down and I was able to self-reflect. And it took some years, let me tell you. It really did. But nevertheless, fast forwarding a little bit, I realized that I had suffered a lot from depression and anxiety. And a lot of times, you know, we may go through those things situational in life, meaning you may have your moment of depression and anxiety, but then there's also those people that are truly what we call diagnosed, you know, where there's that true chemical imbalance and need type of intervention so you can focus. I'm one of those, and I'm not ashamed to admit that. I used to be very ashamed because it was stigmatized. But it brings me to where I'm about to go with you. Just bear with me for a moment. Once I got myself together, I knew that this was needed. So the things that happened to me in the industry, that really was needed for me to get to where I am today, which is a soon-to-be psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner. People don't know that. So I study, I have degrees in mental health. I'm a registered nurse.
That's
absolutely. And I never leave that out in my journey because that's me. That's part of my life. That's who I am. I am Gina Thompson, but I am also that person that is a significantly huge advocate for mental health. So I went through what I went through, and then I began to learn myself through schooling as well and educating myself about mental health. And so God had all that destined for me, and it brings me to where I am today, and now everything makes sense to me. And I don't look at my age, you know. I'm like, you know what, I am who I am, and there's a reason that things are resurfacing with my era, with the traveling. You see it, you guys see it, with the tours, with the music, things along those lines. They're beginning to resurface, and I'm like, well, God, you know what, you had your way. And because I was obedient and listened and finally allowed him to just take that driver's seat instead of pushing him in the passenger, my life is much more better than it was then. And I am so much more at peace mentally, and even with music, I even have a clearer vision, and things are just so much better for me, and God has so much more in store for me, and I'm just continuing to let him guide that path. And that's where I'm at today.
Especially when you got to sometimes take place. Sometimes you got to take time out because this game can wear and tear on you mentally, spiritually. And we've seen so many horror stories and so many talents that fell victim to this because they didn't get the proper break or they didn't really have the proper support system. So they go out there and they do goofy stuff for clout.
Self-destruct too. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Look, we got
some people
unfortunately. Yeah, we got an hour left, and we're gonna run with this because this is something. This is such a powerful pivot we're taking, but it's a necessary step that needs to be in a conversation. Because one thing about it, especially in the Black community, mental health has been stigmatized. But the one thing about it is, first and foremost, we are all people, no matter what color we are. We are God's creations. We are human. And we all go through things in terms of those doubts. When we're dealing with the depression, when we're dealing with bipolar disorder, we're dealing with schizophrenia, you know, we're talking about, people like Donny Hathaway, rest in peace, who was schizophrenic. You know, we're talking about, you know, yourself who dealt with depression. You know, we're talking about a situation where it is something that is already there or becomes exacerbated or comes in the industry, because people don't understand. And like Gene, you know, was saying, when you get in the industry, you know, as we are in this internet age, you know, of clout chasing, you know, endless attention, whoring, and outright depravity for likes, this becomes deeper. Because people are trying to, a lot of times, get their affirmation from an audience that thrives off of, you know, a calamity of chaos.
Okay.
And this is something that back in the era we came up in and you were in terms of the music, this was really about the talent. You know, you were not getting in the game unless you had something. And now we're seeing people getting in the game for no other reason than having a traveling clown show of stupidity. I know that may sound harsh, but we got to keep it 100 because,
you do.
A lot of this stuff, a lot of this stuff we see today, we would have never thought of back in the day. Y'all would have never thought of doing. But tragically, we've also seen, you know, not only just in music, not only with black people, but we've seen with white people as well. You know, Jonathan Brandis, you know, the actor, you know, after the acting work slowed up for him, you know, and he committed suicide. You know, your man that played Jet Jackson, you know, he committed suicide because, you know, this industry, I don't want to be too long-winded, but I got to say all of this. This industry, when you're looking at the attention that it affords you, you get in love with the spotlight. And then when that spotlight goes away, some people do not know how to handle it once it goes away. Aaron Magruder, the creator of the Boondocks, once said, if you want to be famous, stop talking. And that's how some people carry it. Their thing is, I don't want to be in this shit no more. I'm not saying nothing. And then you got some people that are just trying to hang on, but they ultimately, you see them just wither under those lights. Because a lot of people say, I want to be famous. But they don't understand what it really means to be a celebrity when your anonymity is compromised and you become public property.
How about that? You said that very well. You said that very well. I had to
tell us about
that. Yes.
What was the pivot that really made you decide to go into being a nurse practitioner in terms of mental health? What was the day that you decided this is where my next journey began?
Because I got tired of being a guinea pig, almost, if you will, where you're going to the doctors and, you know, they're treating you not on a individualistic approach, but they want to put you again. And it's, I hate to say this, but it's almost like you're the regular depressed patient. And so you get these medications and nothing's working or just whatever the case may be. And I'm like, you know what? I want to learn about the mind myself, you know, and I also want to, because it's heavy in my family, mental health as well. Or should I say there's several. I don't want to make it seem like heavy. I don't want to exaggerate. And I just was curious to just learn more and also wanted to study medicine as well, you know. It was that point in time in my life where, again, where it's all these medications are just being given to you. And I'm like, you know what? No. And just looking at how people are just given certain things and
they're just doped
up. You know, they're telling their doctors it's not working and they're just not being treated effectively. So, again, it just started. It became intriguing to me, and I'm like, you know what? And I just want to understand this more. So I begin to, you know, and I've always loved to help people in general. And so I just decided, you know what? I'm going to go to school, and this is what I'm going to do. And mental health really, really stood out. And because there's so much of our pediatric population that is struggling with mental illnesses because of the bullying and, you know, and just the peer pressure. And it's so much like 10 times harder than when I was a teenager. And mind you, I have 3 kids, you know, one's 29, one's 20, and one's getting ready to be 13. So my kids have, you know, had their moments of going through a number of things, and it is affecting, and they talk to me about their kid, their friends, and it is affecting this pediatric population. Not saying that it's not doing the adults or the geriatrics, but it's affecting this pediatric population something terrible. And so I, again, wanted to just put a focus in on that. And I do motivational speaking as well, and I love doing this, and I love talking to our young people. I'm on our kids committee here in our development, and what we do is we try to, like, you know, we try to encourage our young people. I know I'm kind of going for a spin a little bit, but nevertheless,
the mind is
powerful, and if the mind's not right, nothing else is. And these kids are going through so much. The world, you know, even with a lot of adults, how just the cost of living, and it's stressful. Your jobs and not having effective coping skills, and people are, you know, turning towards substance to. I will get real deep with this, so I'm just going to just calm myself down because this means so much to me. But
no, it's okay.
People are destroying themselves, and there's just so much that is happening. And I know I can't save the world, but I do try to be a voice as much as I can. And I even mentor people as well. And I've helped a lot of people out, and that's the joy that I get, is when my patients say the, aha, oh, my gosh, what you said to me works. That's what I love to hear, that I've helped someone get through something that they didn't see themselves being able to get through, or just helping them, or even if it's a loved one, you know. I love doing things like that, and I know how much that actually even means to me when I'm like, I feel good. This is helping me. This is good. I feel like I feel worth living. That's a beautiful feeling. And many people are struggling with that. So
I think there's also a fear, because a lot of people are dealing with it any other way, but I think there's a fear of people wanting to show their vulnerability to the public, or showing vulnerability to anybody.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And like I said earlier, it's a stigmatization. It's a stigma. It's a stigma. But, you know, what I try to encourage people is, you know, to let them know that it's okay to not be okay. Say something. Just say something. It's you're not alone. And when they hear that and can receive that, they're more wanting to open up and feeling more comfortable. But it's getting them to that point. And that's why I say I tell my story. I don't hide it. I'm a living witness. I tell people, I've been there, and there is help. Where there's a will, there is most certainly a way. You're not alone, and I preach that to these people. And a lot of them have so much respect when I put myself in that category. And then I'm not putting myself in that category just to do it. I have been there, truly been there. So I know when you feel like, should I just let myself go? Should I just give up on life? No, I know exactly what that feels like.
I mean, when we look at what happened with Phyllis Tynan, rest in peace, you know, she dealt with depression.
Okay.
You know, Kurt Cobain from Nirvana, you know, he had like three of his uncles that committed suicide by guns. And, you know, with Kurt, you know, Kurt never wanted to be famous, you know, and when Nirvana really began to get big, you know, he dealt with a lot of it in his adolescence. And when he became a musician and became a big famous musician, psychologically, he wasn't ready for it, and it became too much for him.
When
you look at that guy Houston, who sang that song "I Like That," that dude stabbed his own eye out. I mean, you see these situations with these artists that, you know, and just people where you're trying to compartmentalize something that might be too much for you to, you know, really hold in, because it becomes a time bomb that's going to explode one way or the other, whether you have mass shooters or whether you have suicide. Because one way or the other,
that agony, that pain, that distress, that hurt is going to come out, and when it does, it's not going to be pretty. So the intervention is the best interest you have in an individual to prevent those incidents. When you look at the music industry today, because we are seeing this of what goes on. You are a professional at this. So you're seeing how, in terms of how music is marketed now, how some of these artists are acting in terms of their public personas. I don't want to get on the pulpit because, you know, me and my brother, we are children of the hip-hop as well as you are. But there is a diametric difference of how we understand it and how some of the youth understand it today, because it's like the radio. They play the same damn songs 15 times. I'm like, we listen to everything growing up. It's like like these kids are listening to one particular thing and it's being drilled into them all the time with the drill music. I'm like,
it was the same type of sound with different artists.
Exactly. And it's like they're not seeing anything else. Now, does this mean we are against drill music? No, because we're against music that sucks. We love gangster rap. We love conscious rap. We even love thought rap if the song is hit and it make the club shake. But we are not into music that constantly is about the negativity, because we're not negative
of
people.
Course.
We want stuff that's going to make us feel good, that's going to make us party, that's going to make us sing. And when you see a lot of the youth today, it's like everything is the same thing they're listening to about, I'm going to snuff the ops. I'm going to speak on the dead ops. You know, and social media has got everybody fucked up where they think if they're not rich or famous, that they're a failure. And I'm like, no, there's more to life than celebrity and cash.
Yep, or if you don't like my post, you don't like me. And, oh, yeah. That's what I was saying before. Like, my children have it 10 times harder than me, and that's why a lot of times I try to be, you know, very, very, you know, understanding and patient and, you know, I listen to them. I'm so thankful that they're open, that, you know, we have a good open communication. But I sometimes I have to catch myself because they go through so much.
Right.
So much. You know, I didn't have that social media like that. I mean, I might have had the bullying and teasing going on, but they're, like I said, I mean, you just said it as well. It's a lot with our youth. It's a lot, and I try to stay in my kids' ears, and I try to also at the same time keep my ears open for them, because I want them to know, please, you can tell me anything, and my husband as well, like, they know they can tell us anything, you know, and they still struggle with things, even though, you know, my husband and I do, you know, we pray the best for them, we try to be there for them and, you know, encourage good behavior, discourage the bad behavior. And, you know, just try to do the best that we can, you know, and they still go through changes. I mean, it's that tough. So I can imagine those children out there or those young people out there that don't even have that support system, you know?
Yeah.
And then you have the great, the social, it's really tough. I talk to patients every day, and a lot of them are parents of the patients. And I'm referring a lot to behavioral health.
When you're seeing the behavior issues, Gina, how much is it more of the hereditary more than it is the we're speaking on the youth in this perspective. How much is it more of what the hereditary issues are more than just how the youth are trying to navigate their way? I remember a song by Flotsam and Jetsam called Waiting Through the Darkness. It was released off of their fourth album called Quattro. And the opening lyrics were, you put a gun to my head, the storm too deep, outlook dead, and now that anger, nothing good ever lasts. Moody violence. I mean, if you and your husband
people expressing their mental health
song,
through whack. Because, you know, people putting that in mental health to whack. We even go back to even back in the day with the ghetto boys with five playing tricks on them.
What was it, the ghetto boys what?
I said we can go back to when people putting their mental health on display, going back to mind playing tricks. Even when you go back with Biggie, where he talking about, I'm ready to die.
Yeah. No, it's real. And again, I mean, like I said, a lot. One of the big things is especially for our men, you know, like, you know, I mean, you guys cry too. And you bleed just like we do. And so I find it a lot more harder for the men to speak on it. And it's suppressed or it's projected in other ways. And then even if those ways are brought to the mindset, now, not all, it's I don't know, it's this thing, a man is not supposed to see a therapist or a man is not supposed to, you know, say that they're depressed or, and I find that a lot with male patients, it's not manly. Well, what is it then? Because we have the same chemicals in our brain. We all go through problems.
Yeah. Right. But I mean, it's a situation where, especially in the black community, where we have already dealt with so much in terms of being the villain. You know, whether, you know, I don't want to go run too far down the road, but I want to kind of give a context to the conversation, because especially for all black men out there, you know, we get villainized a lot for being, you know, all types of the worst elements of society, which is not true. Everything from being criminals to being deadbeat fathers, and obviously all of us are not that. You know, but it's also about the point of we're supposed to be the pillar of strength at times, but even then it's hard for us when we're dealing with racism, we're dealing with discrimination, you know, profiling, you know, being, you know, trying to break generational curses in terms of what we may have been raised up under or what our genealogy may have beneath the surface. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we're forgetting about that thing called slavery that is still in our DNA, where we still have PTSD from what our ancestors have had and passed down to us through generations. So, yeah, we got a lot we got to deal with. And then it's also to the point of how you're having a lot of issues with a lot of black men who are having issues in relationships because of that, because they have never been raised in an environment that has facilitated meaningful and deep conversations, acknowledging feelings, and most importantly, being able to talk about that in a free and candid fashion. We have to make these conversations the imperative. We have to normalize this kind of dialogue.
That's it. And that's key. Again, it's okay to say that that you're not okay or, yeah, you should be able to talk about this. One thing that I am finding or that I try to promote, the God honest truth, is support groups, because people will begin to, I've been told that a lot of people find that even in these support groups that they are not alone, and they feel like that's an area that they can go, they can talk to people and find that, you know, and doing this routinely, not just once in a blue moon, like having these routine support groups, some people find it to be very therapeutic, you know, as an effective intervention to kind of even help them, you know, cope, you know, with what it is that they may be going through. And I've gotten some really good feedback from folks that have been recommended, you know, to talk to people in support groups. And they do, there's many of those resources that are out there, you know, and a lot, some of them are even online. You know, a lot of people, especially since the COVID, you know, some people don't do a lot of the in-person, but there's a lot of things online. And it's a matter of being informed of what resources are out there to help support people, especially for those who may not be willing to be upfront and say, or come out and say, this is what I'm going through. They may not be comfortable. Well, providing, you know, or empowering people with resources to let them know, well, here, this is out there. This could possibly help. And again, I'm finding that support groups are becoming very, very big today. I mean, they've always been out there, but you know, community resources, support groups, a lot of people are turning to them more today, you know. And, again, that's just based upon the statistics and the feedback that I'm getting just in my field. And people are liking it. But, again, it's, I still say it still goes back to, you know, with that stigma, a lot of people feel as though, you know, they're embarrassed to say it, you know. They're ashamed to, but no, that actually, you know, makes it worse. But getting someone to, you know, see that's what it's doing, that's a struggle in itself, you know. But what if you can get over that hurdle, you know, or I tell you, if they can get over just that hurdle to see that you're not alone and it's okay to say that I need help, or you know, and once you and it's almost a liberating feeling admitting that. It's almost like in comparison to someone who's an addiction, who has an addiction. I'm addicted to drugs and I need help. Well, I'm depressed and I need help. It's almost along those lines. And just by saying that and receiving that help, it's a really, really, it's almost like a form of liberation. And I know personally myself going through my changes, like when I know there's something wrong with me, there's something wrong and I need help. I want help. And I sought help and it saved me. You know?
That's powerful. I remember when Deion Sanders years ago, when he did an interview and he was talking about, I think this was in 1998 when he was, I think he either was going to drive his car off a cliff or he might have, but he had gotten injured. I want to make sure I get this right, but I know he had said that that was his intention, you know, that he was going to off himself, you know, because, you know, he was just, you know, and Deion, when we were coming up, was like, he was a damn man. I mean, prime time was prime time. But Deion said that when, as he got out there and, you know, his life of doing what he was doing, you know, just wilding, knocking off all these chicks, just living wild, it was beginning to take a toll on his sanity. And he got to a point psychologically where he could not deal with it anymore.
Right.
You know, and so it happens to everybody. During your time in the industry, Gina, because we're not going to ask you to give any names, of course, did you see a lot of people who were struggling with the anxiety? I mean, I could speak of Mary J. because she spoke about it before in terms of the things she had dealt with, in terms of the feelings she had. The My Life album is an audio testament of all the struggles she was going through when she dropped that. And ironically, that's the album that we all love, because that was her most vulnerable and raw. Who did you come across in the industry, you know, in terms of some people? You don't have to name names, of course, but what situation did you see with some people you came across in the industry in terms of things they were dealing with?
Well, I'm going to tell you this much. When I was in the industry, I didn't even pay attention to that because of myself being all over the place. But once I came out of the industry and I just started reflecting back, and once I started being much better within myself and, you know, realizing and understanding what was wrong with me, I was able to then look back and say, you know what, so an easier way to answer your question is, for every 10 people, half of them were depressed. Half of them had anxiety. I would say 50% for everybody that I've had an encounter with or talked to, whatever the case may be, 50% of them. 50. And a lot, and like I said, myself, like, I hid a lot of things. Like, I realized, I'm like, man, when I look back, like, how I was acting, it was so very, very, just was not myself. Like, but I thought I was, you know. Oh, there were so many people like that. So many. And you know, like you say, you've already, you know, you've mentioned Mary, but she did verbalize it. But I guarantee you, because there's so many of them that, as we've already seen in the entertainment field in general rule, how many people that you would least expect, you know, unfortunately committed suicide or came out later and said that they suffer from depression, and people that you probably would never, that DJ, I forgot his name, but.
Yeah, from Ellen DeGeneres' show.
There you go. And I didn't even know him, but just the talk about him, how No one saw that one coming. No one. And what is it? Mork and Mindy? Was it? Didn't he commit suicide?
Yeah.
Thank you, Robin.
Was
another one,
yeah,
right?
He was Robin Williams. Yeah, because Robin had like a whole bunch of he had like I think a Lewy body disease. He had like three or four different afflictions. And I want to say he might have even had a early onset of dementia. He might have had onset of dementia.
And then the guy from Soul Train.
Don Cornelius.
I mean, everyone said he was just, and I'm saying just the list goes on, but it's just one of those things, like people that, you know, you hear that they say they never saw, like, not even a little clue. Not even a little clue. So, again, when you ask that question, probably half the people I came, you know, or knew in the industry, half of them are probably dealing with depression and anxiety. Absolutely.
Yeah, Twiggy, I think. DJ Twitch. Yeah, from Ellen DeGeneres. And I think with Don Cornelius, he had, you know, because the medulla, how do I pronounce this? Medulla. Anyway, it was basically one of the your brain, and he had like medulla and oblongata. Oh man, it's because I'm gonna remember this after the show how to properly pronounce it. But his brains were literally scrambled. It was just like those like a lot of those the veins in his brain, just everything, it got tangled up, and it was really beginning to impair his thoughts. And I think that's what led him to commit. Read about it. But that's what was going on with him.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
like I said, not even just those that have, unfortunately, you know, committed suicide, but just those, you know, that have came out in the industry and said that they've dealt with depression, anxiety. And unfortunately, Magoo, that just passed, I had a conversation with Missy like last year sometime. I'm going to take it back even further. Shortly before the Pastor Mike came out, of course, me and her had spoken and we talked and blah. And that's the first time we had connected in years since the industry. I left the industry. So we were talking, and I was telling her what I was doing currently with my life as far as being, you know, a registered nurse and things along those lines. And I told her, I said, I am at so much more peace than I am now than I was in the industry and blah, blah, blah. Not that I didn't love music, but I just told her, I said, you know, it's stability as well. So nevertheless,
right.
She was like, you know what, many people, Gina, she was like, you're not alone. Many people have left the industry because it's just too much on them. She said, you remember Magoo, right? And I said, yeah, I remember. And again, this was back in 2021. But I remember she was like, yeah, he was like, he couldn't deal with it no more. And then, you know, unfortunately, I'm not saying his recent death was anything like that, but, you know, I know he was one that I was told kind of, and I heard Tweet was another one that I was told kind of, and this was out there. I'm not saying anything that I was told not, you know, because Tweet has verbalized it too, you know. But Magoo, she was saying that he was going through, and then unfortunately, you know, we heard about his passing not too long ago, but again, I'm not sure what he passed from.
We're not going to say, there's what they said they found. We'll wait for everything to come out, but they did say if those reports are right, that he had a manifesto written just it was just a tirade against the industry. When we think about that era with the gold mine, what Misty and Timbaland did, even with Magoo's rock style, once again, we got to really kind of give our listeners an understanding of what some of these people go through. Because what I'm going to say is going to go kind of in some deep territory, but it kind of shows you how you can be thrown into that hole and you never come out of it. Because when Timbaland and Missy and all of them were doing what they were doing, when you listen to a lot of that music in terms of what they did, they were way ahead of the curve before everybody else was. That whole collective. Mm-hmm. Rest in peace, Aaliyah. They even Magoo, with how his wording, his phrasing, It definitely fit for the time. But Magoo was the butt of the jokes for everything a whack MC was. And everybody would always say, you know, going back in the day about how Magoo was the wackest. Shout out to my man Bezo, because we had a conversation about this a few weeks ago. So we were just talking about that whole thing. And I asked him, I'm like, yo, was that really true that they threw the tapes at him after a show, during a show? And he was like, he's like, because his high school prom was at a place where I think Magoo just happened to be doing a show. I think it was in a hotel. Anyway, Magoo was there. So he just saw Magoo, and Magoo just had like this scowl on his face. So apparently what had happened was they had, Magoo and them had done a show, and he was giving out promo mixtapes, and they threw the tapes back at him.
They threw the tapes back at him.
And VA wonders why at times we can't really get an artist out here because, you know, and I'm not saying anything on air that has not been said in the area of which I live and love is my home. But everybody wonders why Virginia can't, this area, Hampton Roads, really can't get on the map in terms of music. I'm like, y'all niggas don't stick together. That's why. Because anybody that makes it out, y'all always got something to say about them or diss them. And I've rejected the sentiments.
Magoo, in comparison to a lot of these niggas today, he was pretty good. I never considered him to be a whack MC at all. If anything, he fit that lane for what was considered fun rap. I never put him in that lane of a real whack rapper.
Yeah, but Magoo did an interview about it, and he said that it was like, I felt like I was being stoned. I was like, oh my, and I mean, he just, and then when you look at Timbaland and Missy and all them that pretty much go on to legendary status, he was the guy that was left behind, you know, and in that collective, you know, that's got to hurt when you're looked at as the person that basically is riding the coattails of everybody else, but you don't have any talent yourself. If he did commit suicide, we're not saying this, that's what happened, but if he did, you are seeing how that, because this is bullying in the sense of people, not only do they not like you, they're vehement and hurtful in the fact that they don't like you. That's got to be the worst. And
if you're going to throw something, even throw it at the cops and shit. Like, throw it at people like that.
Because
one of the people that I know about that met Magoo, actually, that he didn't carry himself as that type of individual. He didn't carry himself as an arrogant type of guy that wanted that energy.
There's a couple more situations that I'm not at liberty to say. I'll DM you about those details, Gina and King, because I don't think I told King about this other situation either. But there were some other things that happened that some people that I run with told me about that went down with Magoo that really kind of fucked him up further. And it's like, you know, when you don't do anything to invite that negative energy and it still finds its way to you, that's hard, because you're like, why is everybody fucking with me? And he just had enough of it. But this is the one thing I think with social media, y'all, that has really, really, really become a thing, because now where people can also be public, it also gives people a public forum to be vicious. Like Drake said, trigger fingers turn to Twitter fingers. So everybody wants to get out there and see how they can chump somebody when you know fucking well you are not going to run up on somebody in the street they'll use the comfort and the anonymity of a computer screen and a text message to say what they wouldn't run up on to say to somebody in person, because they know what's coming in terms of that emotional reaction. But you know, this is something I think for you being an artist, for me and my brother being podcasters, we take our shit serious.
Right, right.
This is what we do. You know, I'm a little more diplomatic. My brother King is gonna let niggas know if somebody act up what's happening. Cause he gonna let them know.
He already know. Already know, man. He's Danny Glover. I'm Mel Gibson in this duel. You know what I'm saying?
It's like, you know, but the thing is, we are sensitive about our art. We are always going to put our best foot forward. We are never going to, you know, disrespect anybody. We speak the truth as journalists, but we are never out to disrespect or slander anyone. That is not what we
do. Right.
And we damn sure ain't having somebody come up and, you know, talk about us. And you took your craft and you still do. And with this, you have found a further passion that is so pragmatic in the progression of the human condition to, you know, make the situation sustainable and comfortable. What you do is anointed. It is benevolent. It is godly. It is necessary.
Amen. Well said. Well said. Yes, and thank you. Oh, thank you. Absolutely love it, man. I really do. Love talking to people, helping people, you know.
What have you noticed today, Gina, in terms of the industry, in terms of the metrics of how artists are being grown and how they're being bought in as opposed to how you came in? And your contemporaries back then.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
What have you noticed in terms of the metrics of how artists are getting into the game in terms of labels, how they're looking for talent as opposed to how you and your contemporaries years back got in the game?
Well, just honestly speaking, we see that, you know, okay, kind of going back to the social media, you know, you have a lot of artists that are doing independent, you know, working independently, and it's because the, you know, the your record deals just aren't what they used to be, you know. Labels, even if they are signing you, it's almost like the artist still has to go out and really and promote themselves, and you know, and do it almost on their own. So I feel like before that, the artist, you know, they would believe in the artist, they'd sign the artist, and they'd put the money into them and promote them, and you know, do you know, whatever they would do. And you know, and now it's just kind of like, not saying that those label deals aren't out there. They are, but it still seems like the artists are having to do so much more for themselves, which is, I believe, why a lot of artists are staring away from, you know, your quote-unquote average record deals and just trying to go independently, because they're feeling just far more in control. They don't want to put, you know, get their hopes, you know, all up and, you know, maybe finish or complete an album and then end up getting shelved. And so, you know, to me, it almost seems like, and I'm not speaking for all labels, I'm so not, but I'm actually speaking from what some of my, you know, some of my industry people have said to me, like, it's like, they're just not the same deals anymore. You know, it's just not, you know, you're not going on these big promo tours. Now, again, we know that COVID has caused a lot, you know, but even before COVID, you know, those record deals just weren't like how they were when I was getting those, when I was around, you know, when back in the 90s. So today, again, you have artists that are working, you know, independently, you know, hustling and just doing what they got to do on their own. And because social media, with these, you know, platforms and things along those lines, and marketing campaigns that you can just pay money to, and they can just, you know, advertise your stuff, and you can even get in magazines and on television shows by writing whomever, the director of shows, and just kind of getting in there. Artists are doing it on their own anymore, and they're being more successful, or they feel they're being more successful, and they're getting the work done, and it's at, you know, it's how they want it done versus how some CEO of a label wants it done, or, you know, they're their own A&R, so it's more control, and so they're doing it independently. Okay, I hope that answered your question.
No. No, it's a perfect answer, because we're kind of seeing that now from, you know, what we were talking about earlier in terms of when we look at how, I mean, when we think about what it meant back in the day to get a record deal, you know, like, and we said this on so many shows with so many of our illustrious guests, including yourself, it's like, okay, this is the thing. All right. First, you got to sign. This is what a lot of youngins don't understand about how it used to be. You had to get a demo tape. Then you had to get it to the label. Then the label had to listen. Then you might get a meeting with the label. So then you get a meeting with the label. Then there's the talk of, okay, do we want to, you know, maybe do a deal, a record deal. So then they're like, okay, we're going to do a deal. So then it's like, okay, how much money are we going to get? So then there's the money. All right, are we going to get a video? Okay, so now we got to get a crew for a video. Then we still got to get in the studio and record the album. And then we don't even know if the album is. This is how it used to be.
For real.
That's it. And now
what we're seeing is, you know, the young people are getting out there and doing it themselves, which is great. But the problem is that now with hip-hop being the number one music in the world, is that everybody thinks that they can rap. And the reality is,
it's so
football, you know. And the bar has been lowered because on one hand, you know, like we were saying earlier, once the radio stations became corporate, that's when it went to shit, because the DJs did not have a hand in what was being played anymore. They have a playlist now. They got to play whatever their station manager tells them to play, because a lot of these radio stations are owned, you know, by the corporations, Clear Channel, iHeart. So, I mean, it can't be a monopoly if the radio station is owned by a company and they're giving up. I mean, they own it, so they can say what goes. So
that's right.
Everybody says hip-hop is dead. Hip-hop is not dead. The culture is fine. You know, 38 Splash, R.J. Payne, Papoose, you know, Griselda, Mitchie Slick, Nipsey Hussle's legacy lives on the marathon. Shout out to Mike and Keys. I'm K. Franklin, that whole click out, and, you know, shit, who are we missing, King, that we really rock with? You know, Street Soprano,
Ray Guard,
who else?
Ray Guard,
yeah,
R.J. Payne. The list goes on, man, but I will say this. Mainstream hip-hop is in a corpse pretty much. It's a corpse that's just coexisting.
Because
mainstream music is done.
Yeah. Because the bar was up. Because the thing is, you left the door open for too many marginally talented acts. Like King said, that's why it's cannibalized itself to where now, if you really are not good, you're not going to last long.
Yeah.
Even going back 10, 15 years, when we look at some of these acts, you know, doing the snap rap wave, you know, all those artists that were big at that time, you know, Crime Mob, you know, GS Boys, Franchise Boys, you know, D for Real, you know, it's no shade when we say it, but it's like they came along at a big time, but the momentum that they had in that movement back then has not carried over into 2023. And you're talking about this is going back to mid-2000s. You know, so this shows you how fast the industry moves, and if you do not evolve with it, you're going to be erased from it.
Yep, that's right. So true, so true.
You know, and a lot of these youngins today, they're getting in this game just looking for celebrity, but they're not looking for longevity. And don't understand that, you know, at the end of the day, if you might make a big payday, you know, but the thing is are you going to invest that money when you do make that payday, and what are you going to do afterwards with it? You know, we've seen a lot of stories of some of these artists to where they fell on financial hard times because that money stopped coming. You know, and then, you know,
a lot of these guys get that. A lot of guys got to use that prop money, man. That's what a lot of them be doing now.
Yeah. And, you know, we find out that a lot of these artists who claim to have all this money, they ain't really got that money like they say they do.
That's true.
Was that heavy in the game a lot back in the day when you would see a lot of artists who were trying to perpetrate like they really had that paper and they really didn't have it like that?
Yeah, of course. Of course, yeah. You see them crying behind the scenes. Oh, yeah.
So what was the money like in terms of, what was that money like back in the day in terms of what everybody was making? Like, was it, we're not going to ask how much you all were making, of course, but what was it like in terms of those paydays, in terms of doing the shows and, you know, the promo tours and the album sales and all that back in the day? How was it for y'all?
With your standard record deal, like I was saying, you know, before, When you're signing those deals, there's so much recoup that has to be given back to the label. So it may seem like there's a lot that you're getting, but, you know, with your promo tour and then putting the albums out and things along those lines, and if they gave you an advance, you know, things along those lines, you're going to have to pay all that money back. So you may have some artists that they may go platinum, and they still may not really see anything. So when you see all those stories back in the day and things along those lines, it's so very true because the label has to get their money back. And the artist, if you didn't write or produce, you're not going to make any money. You're just simply not going to make any money unless you tour. And you better hope that you have a hit record, you know. But other than that, if you didn't write, if you didn't do the production, you're not going to see that money. You're just not. You got to really sell a lot of records before you start seeing anything. So, yeah, that's how it was. And like I said, and that's another reason probably why, not probably, why a lot of artists are doing, like I said, independently, because they're able to see more money on their own returns. And even with the NFTs that I mentioned earlier, not the non-fungible tokens, with, you know, that's like an investment, you know, where the artists, again, they're able to just get their deals are structured differently, and you're able to make more money, period. It's just more, you know, avenues of an artist being able to have, you know, be more lucrative, you know?
Yeah. And the one thing about it with artists doing independent, because it's all, we're always about, you know, like the late, great Young Dolph said, get paid, young nigga, get paid. But by the same token, you have to have your audience. This is what a lot of artists don't understand on the independent route. Like, when you look at artists like Cormega, you know, Styles P, you know, so many others, you know, Nipsey before he signed his deal with Atlantic, which was really about distribution. When you look at E-40, who maintains Thick Witted Records as an independent, but he has Jive as his distribution company, they have established fan bases that allow them to move. You know, shout out my man Mitchie Slick in San Diego with Vaughn Kind. You know, CJ, Meatface, Mob Boss, the whole Southeast Dago, 619 all the time. You know, Lincoln Forever. You know, they are able to sustain themselves through hard work, talent, really that grassroots marketing, and they really live off of, you know, selling their music and doing shows. If you have an established fan base, it's great because, you know, you are really, really, you know, seeing the fruits of it. You know, just like what Too Short did in the Bay years ago when he was selling tapes out of his trunk, you know. But it's also a testament to an artist to find out how big you really are. And some artists are going to get their feelings hurt on an independent scale because you may be hot in your hood, But you, yeah, depending where you true. At, you ain't getting out your hood. And if your hood can't mm-hmm. sustain you in terms of feeding you, depending on where you yeah. come from, you know, you just another artist still trying to make it.
I got you.
You know,
yeah.
some,
that's so very true.
Some places like,
so very true.
Yeah, some places like Atlanta, New York, Houston, L.A., Oakland, if you got a name out there, you're going to eat. But in some places where the scene may not be that big, you really don't get rich until you get outside of there and really start
that's
traveling
right.
and really, you know, so it's something that don't happen overnight. And we are closing in. I got to shout my homegirl, Andrea D. I told her about the show tonight.
Yeah.
She had an accident, so she couldn't tune in. I'm going to have Gina send me the link to send to her. But she loves your music, Gina. She said she's
well,
still
well, she
rocking
wasn't
with
hurt,
you.
Was she? I'm sorry, she
yeah,
wasn't
she
hurt,
caught,
was
she? Yeah, she slipped and caught a concussion. So she's...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, she's feeling it right now, but
I'm so sorry to
wanted,
hear that. I'll let my husband know as well because we talk to her from time to time. I definitely will say a prayer for her, but I want to send a shout out to her as well. You know, so
I'll send you her IG in your DM after the show, Gina. It'll be coming from T-Max MDA. Okay.
Yeah. No, I
yeah.
have it. Yeah,
see,
I have
okay.
it.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, T-Max and VA, that's me.
Well,
so,
okay.
Gina,
I
we have loved
I want to thank you guys
this.
So much for having me.
We thank
it's
you.
Well,
about this has been terrific. We love this. We really enjoyed you.
Aww.
Thank you.
Thank you so very much, and I appreciate your support. You take care. God bless you guys, and I'm sure we'll probably connect in the near future.
Oh, definitely.
Look, you come back on the show whenever you want. Our best to your kids, your husband, your whole family. Keep inspiring, thriving, and most importantly, you know, excelling. You know,
thank you so much. Absolutely. Have a blessed evening.
You too.
All right. You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thank you.